this conference to point out that why does my son look like me was probably the longest question that people, the human race has been wondering about. Waterways is not, is also among the oldies. It's probably not quite as long as why does my son look like me. But this is the problem I'm going to be talking about, the Benjamin Fair instability. Some of you know about it already, some of you don't, and I'll say something about it. So I'm going to be giving describing a joint theoretical experimental study on the Benjamin Fair instability. If you grew up in knowing about water waves, it's called the Benjamin Fair instability. If you grew up in optics, it's called the modulational instability. It's the same thing. It's just different names for the same thing. The experiments were all done by these three people at Penn State. So anytime I'm talking about the experiments and I say we did something or other, I always mean we in the sense of they. I didn't have anything to do with the experiments. And if I misrepresent what happened on the experiments, the session chairman will tell me my time is up and that I should sit down. Okay. So this picture came from the paper of Benjamin Fair, 1967. One of the things that you're seeing at this conference is, well, instabilities sometimes have a role in creating patterns. That's what you were just listening to. Sometimes instabilities have a role in destroying patterns. That's what's going on here. So this is the end of a long tank, someplace or other in England. They created waves which were as nearly uniform as they could make them across the tank. So you're supposed to think of these as absolutely straight lines, and they propagate down the tank. And as when they got to the other end of the tank, these nearly uniform waves became a mess. That is sort of a picture graph of how the Benjamin Fair instability works. In the same paper, same set of papers, they described a mechanism by which this happens. You put in energy in basically in one frequency, that's what you're seeing up here. And so everything is uniform, everything is nearly uniform, but if you put in energy at nearby frequencies, then these nearby frequencies can grow at the expense of the carrier wave. So you start with energy in one frequency, you lose energy to nearby frequencies, they grow, they lose energy to nearby frequencies, they grow, and pretty soon you've lost all control of everything. That's water waves. 20 years later, the same thing was worked out in optics. So think of taking a Fourier transform of this picture. And I'll show you the corresponding experiment in optics. This was from a book by Hasegawa and Kodama, but the experiments were done a bit earlier. The top picture, you can think of as the Fourier transform of what's over there. And then the statement is, if the amplitude gets large enough, then one frequency generates sidebands. So these are the sidebands which grow at the expense of the carrier wave. If the amplitude is larger yet, or if you wait longer, then the carrier wave generates sidebands, they generate further sidebands, and so on. This looks like evolution, but it's really not. It's really four different experiments in which they had different carrier wave strength initially, and therefore, well, the instability is such that the growth rate of the instability is proportional to the square of the amplitude of the carrier wave. So the stronger the carrier wave is, the faster this thing grows. So what's going on here is the carrier wave is getting stronger and stronger as you come down. So then in a test tube of test length, of finite length, you see more and more instability by the time you get to the other end of the test section. The difference in time scale between here and here is 10 to the 15. It's the same phenomenon with a different time scale of 10 to the 15. If you go from here and go another 10 to the 15, you come to the age of the universe. So there's a very large range of time scales over which you're getting exactly the same phenomenon. Okay. So The difference between this picture and this picture was different different areas and 20 years. Go from here another 10 years forward, and there were some experiments done by Joe Hammack at Penn State. This is a wave tank. This is a much smaller tank than that. This is about 6 feet across, 12 feet long, and all those things up there are little paddles. And then they can program these paddles to do whatever they want. So then they created this two-dimensional pattern across the tank. And then the fact that you see a two-dimensional pattern across the tank is not a big deal. They put that in by hand. What is a big deal is this thing propagates down at least this distance, and there's no evidence of any instability at all there. And I should say, since Tony Roberts is sitting right there, Tony Roberts predicted solutions of the water wave problem like this, well, 10 years before Joe Hammack created them. And did Joe Hammack remember about Tony Roberts' predictions? He knew about them, okay, all right. But I should say, when Joe told me he was going to do these experiments, I said, don't do them, Joe, because there's a Benjamin Fair instability. You'll be wasting your time. And I'm happy to say he ignored me and proceeded. So here are waves in deep water, and there's no evidence at all of any instability. Here are waves in deep water, and there is a lot of evidence of instability. And the question is how to reconcile this picture with this picture. It's actually more complicated than that. Here's another experiment in the same tank. Things are slightly different. The different parameters are listed there. And there's no evidence of any instability here. There's lots of evidence of extra stuff going on here. So forget about Benjamin. How do I reconcile the experiments of Hammack with the experiments of Hammack? That's another way of thinking about it. So that's the problem we're trying to figure out. It is well accepted in water waves and in optics and in plasmas that there is a Benjamin Fair instability. Everybody understands the mechanism. And these experiments suggest sometimes it's on and sometimes it's off. And how do you decide what's going on? Okay. So that's the question I want to ask. Is there a mechanism that controls the Benjamin Fair instability? And in order to get at that, try to answer this question, I'm going to go back to this problem. So those two-dimensional patterns are nice things to look at, but I'm going to be talking about the one-dimensional problem in terms of everything from here on. Okay, so I want to be able to describe this process. And here's the answer, so you can fall asleep right after this. What we're going to claim is, if you put in damping, the Benjamin Fair analysis, all of the analysis that gives you Benjamin Fair in optics or in plasmas or in water waves is all without any dissipation. Put in a little bit of dissipation. It doesn't matter how much you put in. Any finite amount is enough to control the Benjamin Fair instability. So that's the claim I'm going to make. I'm going to do that by showing you two different mathematical models, one of them which has no dissipation in it. Then we'll add a little bit of dissipation, and you'll see how the mechanism comes under control. And then I'll show you some experiments which we did to test that theory. Okay. So let me, I guess, make a comparison with other things you've heard. If you heard me talk about water waves a few years ago, I was probably talking about waves in shallow water. This is deep water. One difference between shallow water and deep water is there is no Benjamin Fair instability in shallow water. So the whole question doesn't even arise in shallow water. And then on Friday, Guillemette talked about her experiments on wind-generated waves. This is the problem of what happens to the waves after they're generated by the wind and the wind's cut off. So there's no wind in anything I'm talking about, and the wind played a crucial role in what she was talking about. Okay. So here's the two models I'm going to be talking about. One of them is the nonlinear Schrodinger equation in two space dimensions. Alpha, beta, gamma are real parameters. And depending on what physical process you're interested in, they're whatever numbers you want them to be. So you can make them positive, negative, as you choose, and then different choose a physical mechanism where those are the right numbers. Okay. A lot of people in this room know a lot about nonlinear Schrodinger equation. The other model that I'm going to describe is the same equation, and I'm going to add a damping term. And so delta is a positive parameter here, and it's zero there. And I put up Miles' name here because Miles wrote a paper in 1967 in which he said, in deep water, here are three or four different physical mechanisms that can cause damping. Here's a calculation for what this parameter delta ought to be. So he gives you a formulas for what this number is. If you've never seen, if you've seen the nonlinear Schrodinger equation but never knew how it worked, what it has to do with physical problem, I want to go through that a little bit because it's important in making comparison with the data. So think of, let's go up here, think of eta as the water surface. It's the height of the surface above some level that you choose. And it depends on two spatial dimensions, the horizontal directions and time. And you're looking for small but finite amplitude waves which are traveling with some, what is a carrier wave. So K, capital K and omega are the wave number and frequency of this carrier wave, and then you allow the amplitude to vary slowly in the direction of propagation and in the transverse direction and in time. So in the nonlinear Schrodinger equation, this x and y and t are all scaled variables describing slow evolution in two space dimensions and time of the amplitude of a carrier wave. So if you just look at this equation, there's nothing to tell you that there's a carrier wave. You have to know that. And when you get ready to make a comparison between solution of this equation and an experiment, you have to put the carrier wave back in. There's one frequency difference. There's one phase difference between what comes out of the nonlinear Schrodinger equation and the physical experiment. This equation has been derived by lots of people, starting from, well, water waves at least. This equation is a little bit ad hoc, but it's got a big history. Here are papers by people in water waves and in optics and in plasmas where they used this model, either explicitly or implicitly. And I put Hasegawa and Kodama in red because the first half of this talk is in their book. They did everything we did except draw the conclusion that follows from all the calculations that they did. So it's a bit of a puzzle to me that somebody in this group didn't reach the conclusion we're reaching before we did. Okay. So what I want to do is start with the nonlinear Schrodinger equation without any dissipation. The solution which corresponds to this picture is spatially uniform in x and y. So that means you take, it's the envelope, remember, that A is the envelope of the carrier wave. So drop this term, drop that term, solve that equation, and the solution of the nonlinear Schrodinger equation corresponding to that wave over there has this form. And this term, this extra frequency term, is the correction to the frequency that comes from having a finite amplitude wave. Stokes was the first person to have worked that out 150 years ago. And this is exactly Stokes' formula. So now to look at the stability, again, a lot of you in the room have gone through this calculation already. I hope I'm boring you. I want to use the same procedure to do the second problem. That's why I'm going through it. To look at stability, we're going to take that solution, factor out that phase, and add in a perturbation, linearize the equation. You get linear partial differential equations. They have constant coefficients in this case. So you can look for exponential solutions. K and L are your parameter, give you the wave number of your perturbation, and you're looking for a solution where omega has got a negative real part. Because everything is so simple, you get an algebraic equation for what omega is. So this is KL space. Your favorite wave number is right here, and you want to know whether it's stable or not. This factor is constant along these straight lines. This factor is constant along the hyperbola, and the region in between is where the unstable modes are. And then once you pick a wave number in here, this formula tells you what the growth rate is. Any finite amplitude gives you a region of unstable waves. So every wave train like that is unstable, according to this calculation. Let's do exactly the same calculation with the in the presence of damping. So I just, same equation, except I add in this damping term. The spatially uniform solution means you throw away those two terms, solve that, and now the amplitude is decaying because we put in damping, and then this is the phase correction, which has to do with the finite amplitude. So if the amplitude is decaying, the phase correction is not a change frequency, it has to slow down. So it slows down and comes to a stop eventually because you put in the damping. Now we linearize around that, and I'm going to factor out not only this phase term, I'm going to turn this off for a little moment. Factor out the phase term and also factor out the damping term. So because of that damping, everything is going to zero. And then you could say, well, how can anything be unstable when everything's going to zero? And the answer is, these guys are unstable if they grow relative to the constant. So yes, everything is going to zero, but I'm looking with a microscope, it looks finer and finer as time goes on, so that I can keep on watching to ask whether the perturbations grow relative to the constant. Play the same game. You can look for exponential solutions in X and Y. You're not allowed to look for exponential solutions in time because there's time in the equation explicitly. So instead of an algebraic equation, I get this ordinary differential equation, and it's a simple problem. So I know for sure that this equation has exponential solutions when this product right here is negative, and it has oscillatory solutions when the product is positive. It's virtually the same calculation we did before. This factor is zero along these straight lines. This factor is zero along the hyperbola. The region in between is the unstable region. And here is the crucial difference between damping and no damping. The location of the hyperbola depends on time because of this exponential factor. So you pick your favorite unstable mode. It's right here. And it grows. And it keeps on growing until this hyperbola sweeps past it. And once it has swept past it, then your favorite mode is not unstable anymore. So it grew for a finite time, and it stopped. Every single mode grows for a while. Every single mode that starts out in here grows for a while and then stops. I can make that more precise. This is linearized stability. There's the equation again. And the statement is, start with initial data. Here's a bound on how big the growth can be, how much growth you can have. It's a finite amount for every wave number. So what does stability mean? Well, stability is an epsilon delta game. According to the Lyapunov definition of stability, says you give me an epsilon, which tells me how big you want the perturbation, how big a perturbation you're willing to accept at any time, and I have to give you back a delta, which says make sure your initial perturbation is no bigger than this. But I've just told you that every single mode has a bound on how big it can grow. So you just sum over all of them, and I can always win this epsilon delta game. So in that sense of stability, there is no instability, because instability really means growth forever, and there's no growth forever. Yeah? Yes, yes. Yeah, that's a uniformly valid bound for all frequencies. And then you just sum over all of them to get, and then the ratio between epsilon delta is the square of that. Okay. So that's linear stability. And then you could say, well, maybe there's a nonlinear problem. Nonlinear stability is, I'd like to say nonlinear stability is the same. In one dimension, I know how to show one nonlinear stability is the same. In two dimensions, there's still some fussing around I have to do. I hope somebody in the room can tell me what I'm doing wrong, because I think it's the same. I think there's no difference between one dimension and two dimensions, but I can't yet prove it. So that's how the theory goes. The theory says there is no instability. As soon as you put in damping of any amount, then you stop the growth somewhere, and that's all you need to stop the to destroy the instability. Yeah? Repeat the whole thing. That's an important question. Yes. Yeah. So stability has to do with small perturbations. Even nonlinear stability has to do with small perturbations. And the thing you're talking about is up here. And in order to keep away from up here, the statement is, I want my epsilon to be down here, and then I have to give you a delta, which is even smaller than that. And I'm telling you, if you start dealt with delta that small, you'll never get up to this big, and therefore you'll certainly never get to that big. What happens way up here is not an issue about stability anymore. It's a relevant question, but it's not an issue about stability. Okay. So let's switch to the experiments now. In fact, that the issue about did you prove linear stability or nonlinear stability in that particular model is sort of moot. It's a little bit irrelevant because the model was a bit ad hoc anyway. So the real question is, how does it compare with experiments? So this is a long one-dimensional tank in the Penn State lab. The pictures I showed earlier were in another tank. It's sitting right over here somewhere. So this tank, there's a paddle on one end, they create waves, the waves propagate down the tank. It's about 40 feet long, 43 feet long, and they measure the waves at various locations, and they measure the waves as they propagate by. So distance down the tank is the time variable in nonlinear Schrodinger equation. Let me show you the experimental data. This is a typical experiment. Here's the frequency of the carrier wave, and in order to watch the perturbations, she seeded the instability. So she put in not only the carrier wave but also a nearby frequency. So which sideband will grow was influenced by the initial conditions. So here is the modulated carrier wave initially. It propagates down the tank this way, and then it keeps on going for even longer time over to here. Put it over here. So you can see the wave is evolving, changing its shape. You can certainly see it's losing amplitude over the distance of the experiment. Okay. It's a bit more convenient to look in terms of Fourier transforms. So let me put that picture up instead. These pictures are the Fourier transforms of those pictures. So this is the raw data, and this is Fourier transform of the same information. And if you've looked at pictures of Benjamin Fair instabilities before, you'll look at this picture and say, yeah, that's a Benjamin Fair instability. Here's the carrier wave. Here's the two sidebands that were put in by hand. If you're a true believer in nonlinear Schrodinger equation, nonlinear Schrodinger equation knows about this much of the spectrum and doesn't know about anything else. This is the harmonic of the carrier wave. All this bump is the harmonic of that. And this is the second harmonic of that. All of that is outside of the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. But to get the nonlinear Schrodinger equation, you had to work out the relationship. So this amplitude is basically the square of that amplitude with a coefficient that's in there someplace. What happens as time evolves is, here's the carrier wave, there's the sidebands that were put in, and here you can see two other sidebands starting to grow. and then they get bigger, these get bigger. As they get bigger, they grow more sidebands. By the time you get down to here, there are many sidebands. Okay, that's how everybody knows the nonlinear Schrodinger equation works. So then the question is, what about the amplitudes of these guys? So I'm going to tell you about the time evolution of the two sidebands and the near sidebands that they generate. I could tell you about more, but you can't measure anymore. And also what happens to the carrier wave and what happens to the harmonic of the carrier wave. All of that comes out of the damp theory. In order to do that, we have to put in a value for delta. The question is, what's delta? As I said, Miles gave us some formulas for it. What they found in their lab, in fact, what got us going on it, was they find the difference between that nice pretty picture I showed you initially and the one with lots of mess was how long has the water been sitting in the tank? That's the important parameter. There's some kind of film that forms on the surface of the water, and you probably don't see it, but it's there, and it provides a damping mechanism. And then as the water sits in the tank longer, the damping gets more. So then each day, we have a new damping rate. So let's measure damping when we start. So this equation says, take the L2 norm of any initial disturbance, and then if there were no damping, that would be a constant of the motion. With damping, it's not a constant of the motion, but it decays in a very simple way. So then to find out what damping is, just create the wave and then measure the L2 norm as it propagates down the tank. If this is the right model, the L2 norm should, all the dots should fall on an exponential curve, and then that exponential curve tells you what delta is. So that's how we get delta. Each day, for each experiment, the experiments for that day have the delta that we got by measuring it at the beginning of that day. Once we have that delta, then there are no more free parameters to fit. So here's the first comparison. This is the two carrier waves, the two sidebands, the amplitude of the two sidebands as a function of time, which is really distance down the tank. The dashed line, and I should say that this overall decay has been factored out of this figure. So I'm showing you the solution of this differential equation where that factor has already been taken out, and the data I've also taken out the exponential decay. The dashed line here is what Benjamin Fair theory would predict happens to the amplitude. The solid line is what this equation predicts would happen to the amplitude, and the dots are what they actually measured. The fit parameters are, I just told you how we got delta, and then we made sure that we agreed with the initial data. After that, we just solved the differential equation. And the agreement is quite good with the damped model, and it's not nearly good at all with the inviscid model. The damped model says that the perturbations will grow for a finite time and then stop. In this particular problem, they would have stopped about here. So in this tank, you don't see the end of the growth rate, the end of the growth, but the theory which says there will be an end of the growth also predicts exactly what does happen, so there's every reason to believe that the theory is right in terms of this particular mode. This is a whole bunch of stuff. The curve in the middle is the one I just showed you. There's Benjamin Fair. There's the damp theory and the experiments. The curve down below it is this second sideband, the one that's generated by the interaction of the first sideband with the carrier wave. So again, the theory predicts how it should have, what should happen to it. The data agrees with that. Both of these waves are gaining energy from the carrier wave. So the carrier wave ought to be losing a bit of energy, and that's what you see up here. This is the carrier wave losing energy slowly as its sucked away by these two sidebands. These guys are all in this range, so I factored out e to the minus delta t from every one of those. This harmonic is over here, so if the carrier wave is decaying like e to the minus delta t, the harmonic ought to be decaying like e to the minus 2 delta t. That's what this picture says. The different decay rate because it's the harmonic of the other one. And so not only is whatever they can measure in here predicted correctly, but what is measured in here is also predicted correctly. So everything they could measure is predicted correctly by this damp theory. So where are we? This equation says there is no modulational instability. There's growth of sidebands, but it's a finite amount of growth, and that's not enough to get an instability. The experiments say, yeah, what that theory says is what happens in the experiments. I've shown you one experiment, but they've done several experiments, and we get about that good agreement with all of the experiments we checked. And the question is, maybe this is all a semantic quibble. Maybe Benjamin Fair were right in the first place. This is back to Panos's question. Suppose you're an oceanographer. You don't care about all this epsilon delta gobbledygook. The real issue is energy goes from the carrier wave in the sidebands and then the other sidebands, and then things got out of control. And even though there's a bound on how much it can grow, if it grows enough that all this other, all the energy goes away before it stops growing, then effectively Benjamin Fair were right. There's still a mechanism. We shouldn't call it an instability. We should call it a higgledy-piggledy. I don't know what it should be called. But the idea is that they were basically right in concept. They didn't have the wording quite right. Who cares? So we wanted to check that. So we did, we in the sense of they, did more experiments to ask what happens if we talk about large amplitude waves. What if we put more energy into the sidebands? So the growth rate that I gave you before has this bound. But if delta is a small number, then that thing might be a large number, and then you take e to a large number, and that gives a really large number. So maybe this growth rate is very large for small delta. So the question is, you know, is that what's probably going on most of the time, and all of this is mathematical silliness? If you have a solution of this equation, I've already told you that this integral, which is sometimes called the mass, decays at this decay rate, has this decay rate. And this integral has this decay rate, again, for any initial data that you want, as long as these integrals make sense. So the ratio of them is constant. It's independent of time. If delta is 0, or if its delta is 0.1, or if delta is 1,000, or any delta you want, this ratio is a constant. So here are the results of three experiments that were intended to find out what happens if we soup up the energy in the carrier wave. C0 is the amplitude of the carrier wave. What I just said isn't backwards. But C0 is the amplitude of the carrier wave. It's the same in all three experiments. And then they increase the amplitude of the sideband. So give it more initial energy. Let's get this thing going faster, see what happens. This is the experiment I showed you in great detail. I regard that plus or minus stuff there as experimental scatter. The ratio of the, quote, momentum to the mass is essentially 0 here, and it stays 0 for the course of the experiment. Increase the amplitude of the sidebands somewhat, and it still stays 0 for most of the time, and then something funny happens here. Increase the amplitude even more, and there's a definite deviation from what the damped nonlinear Schrodinger equation says. In fact, there's a definite deviation from what the undamped nonlinear Schrodinger equation says, too. So we were hoping to do these experiments in order to find out what happens to very large amplitude waves with very large perturbations. What we found instead was when we get into that regime, all of nonlinear Schrodinger stops. So is it possible that there's an instability anyway? Maybe so. We can't tell. What we can say is, in order to find out, we have to get outside of the whole regime where a nonlinear Schrodinger equation even makes sense as a model. So maybe they were right all along. That's still a possibility. You're not going to find out until you've abandoned nonlinear Schrodinger models because they're just too simple for that regime. That's the end.